The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
The Justice Department will vigorously enforce antitrust law. Enforcing the law protects consumers from higher prices and fewer choices. That is the Justice Department's legal obligation. That is what the American people expect. That is what they deserve.
That was Merrick Garland, Attorney General of the United States, talking about the Department of Justice's recent antitrust lawsuit against Apple. Welcome back to the Views Room. I'm Anita Ramaswamy.
And I'm Jonathan Guilford. President Joe Biden's administration has taken a hardline stance on antitrust enforcement with the help of officials from agencies such as Lina Khan's Federal Trade Commission. And bipartisan support is growing for policies that could curb corporate concentration. We're joined by Breaking View's global corporate finance editor Jeff Goldfarb and columnist Jen Saber, who have been documenting how the U.S. government is reshaping the deal-making landscape. Stay tuned for this week's Views Room, the podcast from Reuters Breaking Views, where Anita and I will be chatting with our colleagues about the big stories of the week.
Jonathan and I are coming to you from New York. So President Biden and his administration have talked a pretty big game about antitrust law and sort of curbing companies' anti-competitive behavior. Jonathan, what are some of the main ways that we've seen this show up? I know you've done a good deal of reporting on this.
Sure. Honestly, it might be easier to just ask where we haven't seen it. Roughly any type of deal that is of sufficient scale has really begun to just catch a lot of scrutiny from the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, which review all mergers above a certain size, or at least, you know, have a role in doing so. It's really expressed itself everywhere along the chain. So many fewer deals receive the kind of lighter touch scrutiny that was common back under previous administrations. We see deals that do get in-depth investigations held up for longer, demands for documentation and information from merging parties have increased notably. And then, of course, you do see those big antitrust lawsuits that are coming out of the DOJ and the FTC against the likes of Apple and Amazon and Google.
Yeah, so I do want to talk about big tech. You know, we kicked off this podcast hearing from Merrick Garland, and he was talking about the DOJ's suit against Apple that was years in the making that we saw come out. What were some of the main concerns highlighted specifically in that case around Apple?
So it was really interesting because I feel like over the past year, couple years, you've seen these moves in various jurisdictions, most notably in Europe, but also in Korea and other places, to really go after, I guess, what you would call the tolling element of Apple's business. So Apple controls distribution of apps on devices like the iPhone. It generally charges a fee for transactions that happen on that platform. That was kind of the focus of that first wave. The DOJ's lawsuit is really something that's aiming a little bit higher and broader. It's a sort of full frontal assault on Apple's various means of maintaining control over its platforms and preventing users from really being able to kind of see alternatives out there. So the big thing the DOJ focuses in on is, say, you know, if all computing is moving to being done in data centers, maybe you can just have some cheap little beta phone and it can just stream content that, you know, it can be far in excess of the capabilities of the actual device that you're holding. And so for Apple, long term, that's maybe a risk. Maybe they don't want to see the market evolve in that way. And the DOJ is really this kind of future looking agency that's stepping in and saying, like, no, we need to ensure that all of these different paths that the technology market could evolve in, all of those remain open. And so it's kind of going after this huge spectrum of behavior that Apple allegedly engages in.
So there's a lot of different considerations in that Apple suit. And we've also, like you said, seen other actions from the US government kind of targeting other big tech firms. I'm wondering if you could just give me a little overview on M&A specifically. You know, how has this increased scrutiny from the Biden administration around companies and their competitive practices reshaped or changed the M&A landscape?
Sure. I mean, one thing is it just changes negotiations, right? If you are worried that the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission are going to sue to block your deal, you are going to ask for more protection upfront from a buyer. So you see deals with larger fees that the buyer has to pay if antitrust enforcers block a combination, or you see some variety like upfront or staggered payments. And just kind of when it comes to the realm of the possible, obviously that narrows things in, right? You see it in proxy filings that come out related to various mergers. Antitrust is now something that management is talking about all throughout the deal process. So of course, that is going to have some effect on the actual deals that you see. There will be some number of deals kind of on the frontier that just do not get done that maybe would have gotten done in a previous administration.
Got it. And, you know, that's a good place, I think, to kind of segue to a story that, Jeff, you wrote last week. You wrote a piece about all stock mergers and what the U.S. government is proposing and policymakers are proposing in terms of that. One thing that I thought was really interesting in reading your piece is that you mentioned that all stock mergers are on the rise and that they accounted for almost a third of M&A activity last year. And you said that this was the highest proportion in almost 25 years. I'm curious to hear, why do you think this is the case?
I think that the all stock deals are on the rise in large part because of where interest rates are. It's probably to do with the idea that because it's so expensive to borrow now compared to the last, 20 years on the whole, that companies, rather than take on higher interest rates, are seeking other ways to expand. And one easy way to do that is to use your stock as a currency. I think a second reason is that it's been harder for folks to, and by folks, I mean CEOs and boards, to have a meeting of the minds on valuation. And you can try and bridge a little bit of that gap by swapping stock, because it allows the target company to share in some of the upside that may come from some of the cost savings or revenue uplift, commonly known as synergies, that come from a deal. Normally, when you pay cash, you take full control of the company, you get all of the upside or the benefits, and of course the risk if they don't come to fruition. But in this sense, then the target shareholders will end up owning some portion of the combined company and will be able to share in any kind of synergy upsides.
So Jeff, I'm curious, we kind of see this in the broader antitrust space as well, that you do get some support from both Republican and Democratic policymakers for kind of stepped up enforcement. Your piece on this all-stock merger issue also pointed out that, we're seeing Sheldon Whitehouse and J.D. Vance kind of link hands together on this. Do you think that speaks to anything larger here? Like, why are we seeing this agreement? And what does it portend for all of these various government interventions and deal-making under future administrations?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So this all kind of really started, the sea change in antitrust enforcement started, obviously, under the Biden administration with Jonathan Cantor at the DOJ and Lina Khan at the FTC. And we've seen there's been a rallying around that largely from the Democratic side and from the administration. We've seen other agencies, the Federal Communications Commission, the Department of Transportation, the Office of the Comptroller, the Currency have all kind of mobilized as part of this initiative to turn around what has been sort of 40 years of relatively consistent approach to antitrust. And now, I mean, we've seen some one-off situations where the parties have aligned themselves in certain situations. There's a bit of joint opposition to the Kroger-Albertsons deal with the two big supermarkets. But what's interesting, this proposal that came out in Congress, as you said, we have a progressive Democrat in Sheldon Whitehouse and a populist Republican in J.D. Vance proposing a bipartisan bill that would remove some tax benefits that are perceived in all stock deals, which effectively would mean that even if you're getting stock in a deal, you're going to end up paying capital gains tax as a shareholder right away, as opposed to deferring it until you actually have a cash a cash gain on it. And I mean, I think that what it tells you is that bigger, the whole initiative against corporate consolidation and these mega companies really is something of a bipartisan issue. It's not completely, because Republicans are generally more pro-business, pro, you know, let the market do what it wants to do, anti-regulation. But there is this piece where sort of like you take the progressive end of the political scale and the far right of the, you know, of the right wing, and somehow they meet up at the other side on certain issues, and in particular on this one.
Got it. Okay. So durable issues for deal makers, I suppose, no matter what happens in November. I mean, I feels like it somewhat speaks to that, right, that we see maybe some partnership structures that begin to look sort of deal-like, but step around the issue of actually doing a merger. And I know, Jen, you covered the deal last week between Krispy Kreme and McDonald's, where McDonald's will now sell Krispy Kreme donuts in its locations. McDonald's has a market cap of more than $200 billion. Krispy Kreme is only just over $2 billion. In theory, McDonald's could just buy the donut company. Why do you think they didn't do that?
Well, I mean, it's genius that they didn't. So effectively, what they get out of this deal is three types of donuts that are distributed in the morning in McDonald's. And McDonald's has been trying for, you know, a very long time to kind of get their breakfast menu together, right? And so they have the McCafe coffee and you know, the Egg McMuffin, et cetera. And so this is like another type of offering. And it makes a lot of sense because, you know, donuts and coffee, they go hand in hand. But at the same time, you don't have to have all the risk involved in actually doing, you know, a merger or a deal. And as we've been saying, like, one of the huge risks is regulatory, right? And you would think that, well, you know, does the government really care about hamburgers and donuts? And, you know, but this administration and just how aggressive they've been, there's just that, there's a risk, right, for that to be done. But so basically also what happens is it's good for Krispy Kreme too, in the sense that they get automatic distribution into over 13,000 U.S. McDonald's franchises. They've been trying to pull back on their own franchisee operation. So they're going to deliver these donuts fresh to the McDonald's, and they also save on costs, which, you know, it costs anywhere between $2 million to $5 million to build out one of their, what they call a hot and tasty theater or something. It's like one of their shops, effectively. And so, you know, they don't have to do that. And so I did a little simple calculation, and that's basically $67 million in savings. And then, you know, you tax that and you put it on a multiple, and you're looking at over $500 million, you know, kind of an increased market value, which is, you know, basically what Krispy Kreme, on the day of this announcement, their stock shot up something crazy. I think it's now up like 25%, maybe a little more. So it makes sense for both these companies to do it this way.
I mean, you kind of wonder, to a certain extent, if the antitrust policy isn't saving some companies from themselves, because if they're hesitant to do deals, and in this case, maybe a partnership, I don't know if it was ever under consideration at McDonald's, whether it wanted to buy Krispy Kreme. But McDonald's, which is a company that is, you know, storied for decades of building, you know, one of the biggest and best, you know, restaurant franchises in the world, has not had a particularly strong record in M&A. You know, they bought a chicken franchise at one point, they bought a pizza business at one point to try and expand, and neither went particularly well. So, you know, in a way, maybe shareholders should be particularly happy that antitrust scrutiny has grown, because it'll save a lot of companies from misallocating capital.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I'm curious about, like, you know, if you're a big donut CEO versus a big tech CEO, how would you be looking at the current environment differently? Like, you know, are there any sectors of particular concern that the U.S. government specifically has really, you know, cracked down on? Obviously, we've seen with big tech, but just wondering if you've kind of heard about any other sectors of interest.
Well, I mean, we've seen it in certain places. I mean, we did reference Kroger and Albertsons, right? That's like a grocery chain. And, you know, we also are going to see it, we did see it, at least in Europe, with Roomba and Amazon. I mean, it was like a little robot vacuum cleaner, this tiny little company. And yeah, it's tech, but it's also a very consumer-oriented type of thing. So I feel like, you know, everything right now is sort of on the table for regulators. But maybe Jonathan and Jeff have better thoughts on that.
I mean, we've definitely seen it in airlines. Jonathan knows that better than anyone, having covered a lot of this stuff. But we're also seeing it in a lot of different forms. I mean, we just saw this week that Warner Brothers Discovery had two of its board members resign. That also is part of an antitrust initiative at the DOJ to stop directors at boards from serving on companies where there's competition. And in this case, you know, the case was made that these two directors who have been on the board at Warner Brothers for a while and whose parent company owns a big stake in it, were also on the board of a cable operator. And they felt like they're, you know, it was inappropriate. So I think we focus on the big mega mergers where there's lawsuits, and they get a lot of the attention, but the agencies are doing a lot of work down the chain in little smaller places to try and go after what they consider anti-competitive behavior.
You know, throughout this episode, we've covered a pretty wide range of different types of interventions that we've seen from the government. You know, first of all, there's kind of the stepped up antitrust enforcement. We've seen, obviously, the move on all stock mergers that you wrote about, Jeff. And we've seen even financial regulations sort of restraining banks in terms of what they can and cannot buy or what deals they can and cannot do. I'm sure the bankers listening to this podcast will be very curious to know, what do you all think that this means for overall deal making and for the M&A landscape?
I mean, we've seen deal making come back somewhat in the beginning of this year, but there are so many things that were holding it back between 2022 and 2023, higher interest rates, the retreat of bank financing, etc. There is always going to be an ebb and flow no matter what happens. I guess the question is just like, does this affect how high the peaks are, and does it do anything to the composition of deals that we see? You know, if antitrust enforcers are really worried about even the tiniest bit of extra consolidation in an industry, do you end up with private equity just shuffling assets between different financial sponsors, like even more so than we're seeing now, which has obviously been on the rise for a few years? Do you see strategics try and put together these odd partnerships as opposed to deals? Or do you see them do kind of weird structured financing arrangements? I know, obviously, our colleagues have written about, and you, Anita, have written about some of the agreements between, say, a Microsoft or an Amazon or a Google and the various AI companies that need to use their cloud infrastructure. So, I mean, I think it's a pretty relevant question. Like, does it on the margins push activity into these weirder areas? I think probably it has to. There are just a certain number and type of deals that cannot happen right now. But I'd be curious as to whether anybody else thinks there's any other kind of major effect on this.
Well, I mean, as you started the conversation, I mean, this is the antitrust component of this is a cost, just like everything else that's involved in an M&A deal, right? And so this is a cost that has gone up from a risk perspective. And so it gets priced in accordingly. I don't think, I mean, yes, there are going to be certain deals that are going to be off limits now that would have been palatable 3 or 4 years ago. But I don't think there's a lot of those. I think most of them are, it's now a calculated risk. The agencies have lost some of their lawsuits. The law and the way the courts are interpreting it is becoming a little bit clearer. And ultimately, it's really just about the buyer and the seller pricing in appropriately what the risk and the cost of an 18 to 24 month review is going to be. That's ultimately one of the other places where you'll see this, is that if it's going to take you a year and a half to 2 years to get a deal through, even if you win in a court case, or even if it's just a regulatory review that doesn't end up getting opposed or going to court, you have to factor that into the price you're willing to pay, the price you're willing to accept, the time value of that money, the disruption that it's going to create within your company. People are going to leave. you know, all of that. But again, it all boils down to some figure, some cost that needs to be baked into the calculation. And that's what Wall Street does. That's what CEOs do. And that cost is a little bit clearer now than it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, I know there are a number of pretty high profile antitrust cases and anti-competition cases coming down the pike right now. And we've also, like you said, Jeff, kind of seen increased clarity. You know, when I was thinking about the Krispy Kreme deal, Jen, that you wrote about, I was also thinking about Microsoft's deal with Inflection AI recently, where they essentially avoided having to do an acquisition by acqui-hiring a bunch of their staff, which I thought was a really smart move and just super savvy. And I have a feeling that we're going to see a lot more of those sorts of partnerships and transactions go on, especially if a lot of these enforcement cases don't end up shaking out on the side of the companies merging. Thanks so much for joining me today. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anita.
That's it for this week, and thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Sharon Lamb in Toronto and Oliver Tashledge in London. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast player, and we're always keen to hear from listeners, so please leave us reviews wherever you find us.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.